You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maude, and this is episode 004. Today I'm speaking with one half of the founding duo of Timbuktu, Elena Favelli. Now, Elena and Francesca, her partner in putting Timbuktu together, have been working on building apps for the last 7 or 8 years. But it wasn't until about 2 years ago when they put out a book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls that everything in their lives changed. I'm recording this on the side of a mountain along the Kumano Kodo World Heritage Pilgrimage Path in Wakayama Prefecture, Japan. And I'm sitting in what are the remains of what was once a tea house along this path, and I'm looking out over the vista of the mountains in the distance of Kii Peninsula. And for the last couple of days, I have been walking alone, and as you walk alone, you have many thoughts, and I've been thinking about people and books and companies that have inspired me over the last 5 to 10 years. And I can say without hesitation that one of the most inspiring companies has been Timbuktu, and two of the most inspiring people I have met, two people whom I love dearly and who I have been rooting for and will continue to root for, are Elena and Francesca. And so I couldn't be happier to have Elena on the program with us today. I hope you enjoy. Elena, thank you for making time to speak today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
We've known each other since, I guess, like 2011?
I think it was 2012, yeah, when we moved to San Francisco. Yeah, it was 2012.
So I was looking back through email stuff, trying to find out exactly like when we first contacted each other. And it turns out you followed me on February 4th, 2011. That was when Timbuktu Labs on Twitter followed me.
Oh, okay. So, that was yeah. So I guess I got to know you before we met physically in San Francisco. Yeah, yeah. I was I think I discovered one of your articles on the New York Times, and that's how I started to follow you on Twitter.
And then you guys reached out to me, and I kind of at that point in time in 2011, 2012. I was getting all of this inbound about people making apps. So everyone was making a digital magazine and everyone was trying to, you know, put together an iPad app. This was an exciting time to be doing this stuff. And your email came in and I just kind of pushed it off and pushed it off because I pushed everyone's emails off. And then you followed up and you followed up and I finally opened the Timbuktu app and I was blown away. It was the most delightful thing I had opened since I had gotten an iPad. In fact, I wrote back to you right away and I have the email and I said, wow, I just downloaded and spent half an hour with Timbuktu and said, you are all crazy. I love it. It's the weirdest thing I've seen out of all the kids' apps I've downloaded. It has real voice and real character. And then you guys wrote back, I love that you said we're crazy. We are indeed.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't remember this. So, but it's so cool. Yeah, it totally sounds like us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was just, it is wonderful. And I think this is the thing that has been a theme throughout all of what you've made, is that your voice and the character of what you're creating is so strong and so well-defined and so joyful. Mm. When you and Francesca began this in 2011, what was the process of getting to that voice of playfulness that you had?
This was really a natural voice that's always been with us and within us. It's just our, you know, normal approach to life, I would say, you know, before apps and books. So it's really, you know, our tone of voice. And we thought that it could be cool to bring that perspective to the children's media space, which is instead most of the times quite, you know, strictly educational, strictly scholastic, and kind of, you know, people talking down to kids and explaining how things are, how they should be. So we really wanted to stay away from all of that. And we thought that the iPad that was about to come out at the time, or had just come out, was the perfect medium to kind of experiment a bit with, you know, this new approach to children's media and communication. And we've always been very passionate about children's books. So the physical aspect of illustration and of children's communication has always been a strong part of our background and passion. And we really wanted to try to take that and try to bring it and translate it into a digital experience.
Why did you feel the need to bring it into a digital place? What was exciting at that moment that made you think that?
Yeah, I remember at that moment, we had been studying this iPad thing that was before it came out, and it was about to come out. And I remember there was this this hype around it and this promise that it would be the new tool that eventually would take over and everybody would just be on the iPad, and especially children. Maybe they wouldn't read books anymore, but they would just, you know, play with the iPad and learn and read on the iPad. So it was a way for us to experiment with a new medium, which has always been something that we both love. This combination, also like the combination of and the intersection of design and technology, was something that it's always been at the core of our research. And the iPad at the time was the perfect tool to do that, because it really was a design object, but it was also, you know, a cutting edge technology object. It was so new, and nobody knew at the time what they were doing with the iPad, really. Even those people who said that they knew.
Right.
Nobody knew.
I still don't think most of us know what we're doing with the iPad. We're trying to figure out. In that time, though, I mean, what was so difficult was that you had to be a really technical person to make an iPad app, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you could, like, in the same way anyone can make a keynote presentation and kind of make it pretty and make it work, to make an iPad app back then, you really had to be a technical person. And the reason why I was so reticent to open up your app when you first approached it was because I had seen so many other apps that were so boring, that may have been technically well executed, but just had no soul. They were just these soulless technical things, or they'd be, you know, 10 gigabytes of data. It was kind of crushing. And when I opened your app, the thing that struck me was all of the technology fell away, and it was just pure joy and voice and ownership of the space in a way that I hadn't seen anyone else do. I mean, that was ultimately why I got so excited about what Timbuktu Labs could produce, because I, you know, the technical stuff you can figure out, you know, whatever, you can raise some money, you can hire some engineers, you can brute force tech, but you can't brute force voice and joy and a lightness of being and a seduction of just good character. You know, I mean, it was really this feeling of being pulled into another world and wanting to stay in that world. And I remember thinking, well, yeah, okay, this is pretty special. this is not something that you see every day.
I guess that's because we're not tech people.
Right.
Francesca,
<It's good. laughs>
Francesca and me, like none of us, we don't have a tech background. So technology is something that we learned along the way, but it wasn't our main focus. Our main focus has always been content. And I think that's, you know, what's made the big difference in our apps, if you compare them, yeah, to most of the apps that were around at the time, especially in the children's space. There was, yeah, this magical feeling to it that was purely editorial, I would say, way more than technical. And I think that came from our content-related background and interest. We were also lucky enough to find, when we started, a good developer and a friend in Milan, when we put together the first issue of Timbuktu magazine. And he was just as excited as we were about the content that we were producing. And so he was a strong, solid designer who was really happy to experiment with the iPad and with iPad apps, but it was also very passionate about the kind of magic content that we were trying to produce and this new approach to children's communication that we were trying to bring into the iPad. So yeah, it was something that came together very naturally, and we were working out of our kitchen in Milan at the time, and just, you know, on weekends and at night. We had full-time jobs. I was working full-time as a journalist. Francesca was working full-time as a theater director and playwright. So I guess we both brought our, you know, worlds of creativity and imagination into this project that then became a startup.
Magic is the perfect word. You said we're trying to inject magic into this. And I think that's what it felt like. You know, it's like the iPad came with the promise of magic, but so little actual delivery of magic. And the work that you and Francesco were producing felt like actual magic, felt like true magic, which was cool. And so you won a bunch of awards. The app did pretty well. How would you categorize like the goodness of how did the app do well? Did it do better than you expected?
Oh, yeah, it did better than we expected. Definitely. We got a lot of press right after it came out, and especially in the US, which was our goal, because we really wanted to try to move to the US and see if we could, you know, take this project to the next level and maybe bring a company around it. And so it was, it had a nice reception in terms of, yeah, press and design awards, because the design feeling and aspect of it was immediately, I think, one of the most praised aspects of our work. But then it failed to reach that level of economic independence that then gives you the strength that you need to carry it forward. And it never really became sustainable. We were winning awards. We were getting nice press coverage, but we were never making enough money to keep up with the cost. So at some point, it became clear that it wasn't the thing that we could keep doing for too long.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't eat award certificates or use them to pay rent or, you know, hire developers or whatever. Yeah, it's funny. It's like prestige is inversely proportional to commercial success in a lot of ways. You know, it's like the more love you get from the insiders, the more love you get from certain aspects of press, the less mass successful things are or whatever on a commercial scale. But so what wasn't working? I mean, what part of the economic model wasn't coming together? You were giving the app away for free, but you could buy subscriptions. What was the model you were using and why do you think it didn't work?
Yeah. So we tried a subscription model, which, yeah, so with the app, you could download it for free and you had access to a few free content. And then we were asking you to pay for a subscription. It could be monthly or annual. We never reached, you know, a large enough user base of paying subscribers that could pay for the costs. And the cost of production were very high because we really struggled to create, you know, to create these magical experiences that we were talking about before. You really need to come up with, well, first of all, with really strong content. And even just from a, you know, concept perspective, it takes time. It takes time and it takes efforts. And then you need to translate that concept into great experiences, both on the graphic and illustration side and on the technical and interactive side, because we always try to create these stories that could be highly interactive for kids to explore and to play with. So it was costly on the production side. And then, you know, we weren't able to charge crazy amounts of money for the subscription.
What were you charging?
I think we were charging $9 per month. And yeah, I don't remember the annual subscription right now. But yeah, it wasn't a big amount. Yeah, it was pretty much aligned with, you know, magazines subscription. Because at the time, we were positioning this as a magazine for children. And most of the content was around news and current events from all across the globe. And we were just trying to find like a more quirky and an interesting angle to tell those stories to a kids audience. So I think, yeah, partly was the structure of the cost of production and also the intensity of production, the amount of hours and hours of work that we had to put into every single issue that wasn't really sustainable after a while. But I also think that the magazine, yes, we found kind of our niche of people who were in their way raving about this magazine. But then I think we never truly found product market fit, meaning that, you know, most of the times for at least for the mass audience and market, it wasn't clear to them what this was. I remember like this this user sessions like with kids, with parents, and sometimes parents were like, you know, very candidly, what is it? I mean, how are you supposed to use it? Is this is this educational? Is this is this just for fun? Is this you know, teaching them lessons about? And in the US especially, I think there's such a strong obsession with results and with with right. goals, right? And if you're not able to immediately categorize something and say, oh, this is for after school when my kid is reinforcing his alphabet or math skills. And okay, so I'm buying this. If you don't have that, I think especially in the US, it's really hard for parents to make that decision of, yes, okay, I'm buying this subscription to this thing. So it was kind of, you know, this... this mysterious object, I think, for most people at the time.
Do you think anyone figured it out? Like, did anyone else who's out there doing kind of like magazine-y things or kids apps, did anyone find product market fit?
Well, certainly not on the magazine or, you know, publishing side. I think that the only the only apps that are working on the publishing side on the iPad are those apps that created some sort of Netflix for children's books, right? So they're more platforms. You pay a subscription that can be monthly or annual, but it's mostly for content that is then, you know, produced by somebody else. So I don't think that nobody has really figured this out clearly yet. And I don't think, I'm not sure that no one ever will at this point. I don't know. I feel that the app market for children especially is kind of messed up right now. I don't see many people experimenting with it anymore.
I guess like it's a question of like, is the medium fundamentally flawed in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Is the iPad just not the place to do these things? You know, and you guys have made a lot of apps, haven't you?
Oh, yes. We did, I think it was 12 or 13 at the end. Yeah. The iPad, I think it's working when you create apps that are designed around a very specific task, or maybe just a few different specific tasks, but they need to be highly focused if you want them to work and to have users working on them and playing with them on a constant basis. In our case, we were instead trying to create this ever-changing editorial experience. And when we started, it was actually changing every day. We had a different story every day, which was kind of crazy because it was a lot of work. And then it also, it didn't make any sense for the users because especially with children, they love to read the same story over and over again. So we kind of overestimated our ability to capture their attention. Of course, there are some apps that are doing this in the right way. But I think that, again, yeah, they're very specific. And so you have a great app to learn the alphabet or you have a great app to learn the states of the US. And, you know, they're very, very limited in creativity and in scope. And it was never something that was appealing to us.
Right. You had bigger ambitions than that. Does Timbuktu Labs make apps anymore?
We don't right now, no.
Had you announced that? Had you said anywhere, hey, we're not doing updates to the apps? They're out there, but they're not being kind of worked on?
No, we haven't publicly announced any change on that side. So the apps that are out there in the iTunes space, you can still download them and play with them. So they're still working, but we're not producing or releasing any new apps. We just decided at some point to take a break and go back to where we started from and then see, what else could we create?
It's kind of crazy. I mean, there's a lot of this that's happened in the publishing industry. Like your story of 2011, heady days of getting excited about the iPad, going all in on it, doing things like doing daily content updates, huge content updates delivered through these subscription systems, trying to find sustainable models, trying to find new ways for kids to interact and learn. So many people went through that cycle and then ended up coming out the other side, I think in a similar place to where Timbuktu popped out, which is, okay, we're going back to what we know. I don't know if that is saying that print media or traditional media just is a powerful thing, or if it's saying that the iPad is kind of underbaked or the economies under which people are willing to operate on the iPad. So, for example, like you're only willing to pay $2 for an app. Like you're never going to make a sustainable business with a $2 app, really, right? I don't know if that's the problem. So how would you categorize Timbuktu today? If someone said, you know, hey, introduce yourself. What is Timbuktu?
Yeah, I think today I would call it a digital native brand, especially when I think about Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls and the whole movement and the whole community that has, you know, formed around it. So yeah, I would say that today we are a digital native brand, and that we've done this starting from a physical object and a very traditional one, such as a children's book. But I think that, you know, yes, we did go back to what we knew, but we went back with an additional layer of knowledge of the digital space, which I think at the end is what made all the difference, because we were able to really design and create this object, this book, around a clear and specific audience this time. And we were able to capture this audience online with a newsletter first and then with a crowdfunding campaign. And so for the first time, I feel like, you know, we took all the lessons that we had learned along the way in the startup scene and ecosystem of, you know, small iterations and small tests and customer research. And we took them with us and we brought them to this other more traditional space of the book publishing industry, right. Most people and most companies are not doing this. So they still think that, you know, you have this big idea, you create it, you publish it, and then they will come.
Right. And Goodnight Stories kind of had this interesting genesis. You briefly noted it started with a newsletter, which I think most people wouldn't think of doing if they're starting a new book brand. When did you launch the newsletter? Was that at the end of 2015 or end of 2016?
Yeah, that was at the end of 2015. And we used a newsletter for customer research and also product research. Every week we were sending out a short story about some extraordinary woman from the past or the present. And sometimes it was just text, sometimes it was a short video, sometimes it was a, you know, like maybe some illustrations with some text. So we were just testing different formats, different stories, and kind of recording how the readers were responding to these stories.
When you say recording, were you doing actual like A-B testing and tracking clicks or?
Yeah, we weren't doing A-B testing at that point. It was like, I guess, a more superficial level of testing. At the time, we were using MailChimp. So we were using all the usual KPI and metrics that come within those email service providers, and we were kind of tracking the open rate, click-through rate, time spent on then on the blog, reading the story. Yeah, and then we were measuring the pace at which the email list was growing week after week.
How many people did you start sending out to? What was the audience?
Yeah, I was actually looking at that the other day because I was like, oh my God, I really want to see where we started from, because now that the book has been translated into 42 languages, which is crazy. It's just completely
insane.
And so I was like, wait, but where did we start from? And the very first email that we sent was sent to a group of 25 people. So that's where we started from. Because I remember perfectly that we were like, okay, we want to try something new. And so we're not going to use the Timbuktu newsletter. We're going to, you know, start from scratch and try to build this brand new list specifically interested in this kind of content, empowering stories for young women.
Why did you feel like the Timbuktu list wasn't a good starting point?
Part of it was that it wasn't a really active list anymore. And also we took this as a test. And so we were like, okay, if we want this test to be really meaningful, we have to start from zero. Right. We don't want to take with us any of the baggage, you know, positive or negative that we have with Timbuktu. And so we decided to start completely from scratch for this reason.
Wow. And so you started with 25 people, and do you still have a Rebel Girls list now still, right?
What's
can you say what number it's at now?
Oh yeah, sure. So we started with 25 people, and then when we launched the crowdfunding campaign, the first one, we were at 4,000. So this was just after 6 months after. So and now we are at 300,000 people on our email list. So it's exponentially grown. Yeah.
So like the economics of that, what does it cost you to send out an email now? I mean, to 25 people, it's free. 300,000, I'm curious about that. I don't think I've ever asked anyone who has so many subscribers. Are you still with MailChimp?
No, now we are with another company called Klaviyo. So the cost, it becomes expensive. On a monthly basis, I think it's $1,400.
That's not so bad. And that, yeah. Is that for unlimited emails?
That's for unlimited emails to that user base. Oh, yeah.
That's not so bad. Wow, that's amazing. But what a growth curve, though. I mean, that's over basically a year and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
2 years, basically. So you launch the Kickstarter. It does really well. You get $675,000 or so from the Kickstarter, and then you continue on Indiegogo. I mean, I think it's really ridiculous that you can't just continue on Kickstarter, that you have to kind of jump over to another platform. But so you jump over to Indiegogo, and you get to $1.287 million or so. Which is incredible. I mean, and now every year it feels like the baseline of what a lot of money for a Kickstarter campaign or crowdfunding book campaign is gets reset. 7 years ago, it was like, if you got $20,000, that was a lot of money for a book, you know, on crowdfunding. And then 2 years ago when you did Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, it was the most money any book had raised on crowdfunding.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And then getting it to $1.287 million over at Indiegogo. I mean, that's a lot of money for any book. I mean, your goal was $40,000. Is that what
that was the goal.
The initial goal was.
I know.
Wow. And so talk about where the company was when you decided to launch the Kickstarter campaign, because you had been doing apps at this point for 4 or 5 years and they were not proving to be sustainable. Did you feel like the company was in a tough position?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Honestly, the company was dead at that point. Francesca and me, and we had decided to move from San Francisco to LA because we wanted to get away from all the craziness of the startup ecosystem, where everyone was trying to push us to create a platform for kids content instead of creating our own content. So we spent 1 year in LA just really like spending time with ourselves, and we didn't know anyone there. So we just spent a lot of time doing research and trying to reconnect to what was important for us. The company wasn't making money. We were using our own personal money just to survive. And we were, you know, consulting on the side, doing any kind of jobs that you can imagine when you're trying just to, you know, keep things going for a little longer before shutting everything completely down. And it became clear for both of us that, you know, this passion for gender equality and, you know, female empowerment was our biggest passion and focus. Right. And so we decided to do something around it at some point. And since we were in children's media, we were like, okay, let's start from here, because it's just the space that we know best. And we know that we can create something meaningful. It was really the response to a very personal need, and also to a very personal pain, I would say, because as you grow and as your experiences in the workforce grow and expand, you begin to realize more and more how more difficult it is for women, right, to succeed. And so it becomes painful. And so at some point we were like, okay, if we have to keep trying one more time, we really need to try with something that we care about, and something that we care a lot about, because there's no way that I'm going to try to launch a new app on iTunes.
And also, like, there's no way you're going to, like, let some random VC be like, hey, girls, like, you got to make a platform. And, like, if it doesn't hit 1 billion users, you're worthless. And, like, which is the prevailing sentiment, you know, when you're up in the Bay Area. So, I mean, like, I think the fact that you had to physically extract yourselves from that environment, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, as someone who also has extracted himself from that environment, I think it also speaks to just how, God, you know, in some ways, Silicon Valley is so wide-eyed and optimistic. And in other ways, it is so myopic, so tiny. I think it's incredible that you physically extracted yourselves, and then you took some time and space to reflect, which is something that also doesn't happen very often up there. It's keep mm-hmm. going faster, faster, make more. You know, how do you, you know, what, no more users? What's the growth rate? You know, there's no sense yeah. of taking a step back, taking a breath. When you're moving towards the Kickstarter campaign, you're in this place of, this is kind of the last thing we can try before we're really out of money. Is that what it felt like?
Oh yeah, completely. So there was a lot of pressure from us, and also a lot of expectations because we kind of knew that this campaign could become something big. The initial goal was $40,000, but in our mind, we had a secret goal that we didn't even want to share it with each other, but we thought that we could probably reach 300,000 if we were lucky and if everything was going as we thought it should. But then it immediately exploded the first day. I remember the first morning when we were, again, in our kitchen. We always launch stuff from our kitchen. We're Italian, so you know, we have to do that. Right. It's the only way.
It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, well, I guess in Silicon Valley, everybody launches stuff from their garage, and we launch right. from our kitchen tables. That's the difference.
That's the trick.
Yes. And I remember that, you know, we saw these people starting to pre-order the book and buy the book right. and donate to the campaign. And within the first few hours, we had passed, I think, 40% of our funding goal. So it was clear, right. immediately clear that the campaign was going to be funded and that we could go on raising additional funds. So it was, I think, one of the most exciting moments for us was that instant realization that things were going to change and finally right. were going to work wow. in our favor.
Goodnight Souls for Rebel Girls is not the first book of this kind, right? Like, there are other books out there that are about, you know, amazing stories about women and, you know, children's books about sort of empowerment and things like that. Why do you think this book at that moment caught on the way it did?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a combination of many things. And I think the title, honestly, is a big part of it. The title is strong, it works, and it's exciting for people because everyone wants to be a rebel girl. So right. it really...
I want to be a rebel girl.
Yes, why not, right? And it really captures their imagination and they feel that they want to be part of it. And also I think that we did it in a different way. Most of these books that collect stories about real women, extraordinary women, they're usually quite dry and cold, and they're more like little encyclopedia for kids, where they're putting together collections right, of right. Stories, of biographies, short biographies, where the typical tone is, oh, you know, this was the first woman to do this, and this was the first woman to do
right,
that.
Right.
So it's a very, again, it's a very, you know, classical, scholastic approach to exposing children to this kind of themes and stories. Whereas we decided to go with the fairy tale twist. And we transformed these biographies into fairy tales, which I think it's the most engaging aspect of the book and of the stories themselves, because they're not dry biographies anymore. They become this very warm and imaginative fairy tales that you really want to read out loud before going to right. sleep. So I think right. this aspect of creating a story that can become part of your daily routine, of your bedtime routine, is what made the book so successful, because it immediately gave people clear user case. People right. in the app space
right, right, right,
would
right,
say.
Right. I was just going to say, it's like, you know, yeah. with the parents who are looking at the app going, you know, what's the benefit I get out of this? How do I integrate this into my life?
Yeah.
Like, this book is like the perfect product market fit. You say, yeah. hey, before you go to bed, read a story.
Yeah, you know, the like, user case was very clear. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, Silicon Valley isn't entirely wrong about, you know, finding, yeah. you know, like, you know,
oh,
product
no,
market
sure.
is important. It is
important. And I mean, we're so grateful for all that we learned there. So don't get me wrong when I, you know, when I say that we had to get away.
Right.
But yeah.
No. But I think, you know, what you're speaking of again is voice, right? I mean, it's like, it's the same thing that you and Francesca have been doing for almost a decade now. You know, it's like, taking great voice and applying it to different mediums. You know, it's like the iPad app had great voice, but you know, it just so happened that the market there was so weird and the economics of it were so strange and the upfront costs of content production were so high, it just didn't work. But in the case of a book, you've taken that same joy, that same magic, and that same strength of voice, and you've made this object out of it, you know? And how has that been? I mean, like, was there a community around the apps that you found forming? And how does that compare now to like this community that you've found come together around these books?
Yeah. No, I don't think we were ever able to create a community around the apps. It was always a small community, and it wasn't really engaged on a level that you can say, oh yeah, we have, you know, a community of 2 million users. Even if we had 2 million downloads, even at that time when we reached the 2 million downloads, we still couldn't say that we had a super engaged community. It's tough. I think it's tough creating communities around apps. I think it's really difficult, even when apps take off.
What is it about apps that make that tough?
I think that, you know, other than, of course, social media apps, I don't think people have the same kind of relationship with small little icons that they have on their phones. And
you don't hug your icons before you go to bed?
No, I don't. So I think it's quite tough to create a strong sense of community around a single app. And, you know, some companies have been able to do that. And I think when I say this, I think of, you know, some music apps, for example, like Smule, which was part of 500 when we were there. Yeah, there are some apps that have done this and are doing this in some spaces, but I think it's quite rare. With a book instead, I mean, of course, books are social objects by definition, I would say. Right. And they have been with us forever, and we are just used to having them around our physical space, our rooms, our bed, our cars. It's just and they have this physical presence that it's still really strong. And especially with all, you know, with people being constantly immersed and fully immersed in the digital space, I think that this physicality of the objects is becoming more and more important. And especially for something like books that still, although, you know, we, of course, we read books on the Kindle, and I do that all the time, but still there are certain books that I prefer in their paper format, right, that I wouldn't buy on a Kindle. And I think this book is one of those. It's not just a collection of stories, but it's also of this beautiful design object that people like to buy and to have with them on their table or on their bedtime table. And yeah, we see pictures all the time of children hugging the book and taking the book with themselves to bed as if it were a toy or more than a book. So I think that's something that you can create really only with physical objects. And the community that formed around it is just incredible. I think it's the most incredible aspect of all this new adventure. We see every day people sharing pictures from every corner of the globe with this book translated now into so many languages. And it's just insane for me to see how connected they feel to this object.
Right. What are you doing to help foster that connection? Are they all joining your mailing list? Is there an online space that they congregate in? Are you doing events?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're doing a combination of those things. And we're using, on social media, we're using a lot Instagram to collect and give space to these stories, to these pictures that come from our users and from our readers. And then, yes, we use our newsletter as a space for them to come in and to continue to be part of the conversation with us. And then we're doing more and more events in different places. We're doing a lot of events in Europe, where the book has done extremely well. So we're doing events, book signing events. We're doing presentations. We're doing sometimes events even in theater, just reading the story, sometimes with actors, sometimes just Francesca and me. So it's a combination of things, and you know it's ever changing, and we're constantly learning new ways to interact with them, which is, I think, one of the most exciting parts of this work now.
It's interesting that you called a book a social object, right? Because I think one of the promises of the iPad and the digital world was that it was going to make these things that were, I think, non-social. You know, a book is a thing that isn't connected. It's isolated. It's on its own. It's this thing you have an intimate one-on-one relationship with. And even if people are reading the same book, you don't know they're reading the same book, right? I mean, this was like the whole thing of, you know, shared marginalia and let's read a book together and, you know, let's do this on the Kindle mm-hmm. or, you know, on iPad apps or something. And even in Timbuktu, it's like, let's all exist in the same space, right? Let's all gather in the same space and read this text together or experience this story together. But a physical book isn't that, right? And it's funny that the iPad and the digital book spaces, so the Kindle and iBooks or whatever, didn't ever fulfill that promise. But what you've done with like Rebel Girls is you've created these totems that people can form an intimate relationship with. So the kids can take to bed with them, you know, in a way that, you know, is more, I think, understandable because it has edges in a way that like an iPad app doesn't or a digital thing doesn't. But then Timbuktu, you and Francesca have just done such a good job at creating connective tissue. The mailing list, that's the social layer in a weird way on top of a book, in a way that most publishers don't get. So like from an outside perspective, looking in at what you've built, mm-hmm. it's like you have these incredible digital connective tissues. So using Kickstarter, when you use Kickstarter, everyone feels like they're part of it in a way that you can never be part of with a big publisher.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's probably a lot of the energy that you feel maybe is in part because you didn't go to like Penguin Random House and put it out through them. You did it on your own. So everyone feels like, yeah, man, we're part of this. So you have community coming together there. You have community on the mailing list. And then you have all of the kind of follow-up stuff that draws its momentum from what is ultimately an isolated physical thing, right? Mm-hmm. The book. I just think it's interesting that, you know, it's like, even though a book itself is not inherently social at all, it's like the most antisocial thing you can do is like, I'm going to go in the corner and I'm just going to be quiet, right? I'm going to be quiet. I'm not going to talk to anyone. And yet it has the power to kind of transmute that experience in a way that gets people so excited that they're willing to come together. They're willing to gather. They're willing to hold up these ideals, which is really exciting. It's really exciting to see you find that fit. Because I think you've always been moving in that direction. Watching Rebel Girls go from a Kickstarter campaign and watching your update videos are like one of my favorite things in the world. Because it's like you feel how excited you both were. And surprised, you know, and also relieved.
Yeah.
You know, hearing that backstory about where you were in that moment reframes those videos in a little way where there's like palpable relief.
Yeah.
Like, we aren't going to have to give up on our ideals. It's a really incredible transition. And so 6 or 7 years ago, if I said, where do you want Timbuktu to be in 3 years or 4 years? You probably would have said something like, oh, we want to have this incredible app ecosystem and have, you know, millions of paying customers and like producing all this great multimedia content. Today, considering where you are right now and considering the success you've had with these books, what is the ideal of 5 years from now for you?
In some ways, I think that the idea has always been the same. The idea for us and the dream for us was to build a digital media company. And even if the output now is physical books, that doesn't change the fact that we consider ourselves a digital media brand. And so we think, and we've always thought of this book, Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls, as this cornerstone of a larger media brand that can connect with this audience of young women and keep creating meaningful objects for them. And of course, when I say objects, I think mostly about books because books is the core of our expertise, also of our passion, right? So, right. At the same time, I also think about other digital ventures that could come along the way, like this podcast that we're about to launch, which will be called, again, Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls. And this first season will be 10 episodes, each one focusing on a different woman from the past or the present. So we go from Margaret Hamilton to Harriet Tubman to Maria Callas. It's going to be interesting to see how we can tackle this new medium and this new adaptation, right, of our stories with sound, with music, with a host reading the stories in a slightly longer format. So again, it's an experiment. It's a storytelling experiment. We are storytellers more than anything else. Right. And so we love to experiment with different storytelling formats. And so, yeah, I think that we will just continue to do this with whatever we think might be relevant. I think podcast and audio right now is such an interesting space. Maybe just like the iPad was back in 2011, 2012. You know, it's one of those new emerging spaces where you feel that you can start to work in and start to experiment different things and see what works, what doesn't. And so you feel that you have the freedom to experiment, and you also are trying to do something that is quite cutting edge, right? Because it's something new that people are now doing it. Well, radio, of course, is not new, but the podcast consumption is new and the podcast format is new. So I guess that's also what's exciting for us. It's always trying to be one step ahead, or at least try to be, and keep experimenting with every new platform, format, medium that seems relevant to the storytelling experience.
When you think about the podcast, how do you think about it in economic terms? Not to be like coldly business focused or whatever, but for me, one of the questions I ask anyone who's doing, either if it's a startup or books or whatever, it's how do you keep it sustainable? Because ultimately, you know, that sustainability is what enables more magic to exist, right? You have to keep that in mind. So when you think about something like this podcast, how does it fit into your overall media strategy for the company?
Yeah, well, for this first season, we're not going to have ads. So there's not that piece of monetization. And so far, it's just sustained by the sales of our books. And so the business model there, it's so far is very simple. It's just we can afford to produce it and to make it because we're selling our books and we're making enough money to start this new production. In the future, I don't know. I mean, there are, I think, a bunch of different things that we could do around it. I think that if the podcast becomes successful and keeps on building an audience, very targeted audience, it can become something very appealing for a sponsor, because of course we are talking to a very specific kind of readers. But it could also become something that we could try to sell with a subscription, because of course it's a recurring episodes, and if people want to like them and want to listen to them, that could also be an option. But yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I don't have an answer now. I think it's something that we will need to wait and see. And honestly, that's what's most exciting for me right now, because we don't know. I mean, we are entering this field and we don't know, and we will, you know, find out along the way.
Well, that's the nice thing about having a book, is like people underestimate the power of being able to sell. How much do you sell Rebel Girls for?
We sell it for $35. And the reason why we were able to make a lot of money with it, given that we're talking about business and money, is that we decided to be completely independent. So Timbuktu, our company, is the publisher of the book. So we didn't, as you can imagine, after the crowdfunding campaign, we started receiving gigantic offers from all the big publishers in the
really well. Can you
in
can
the
you,
U.S.
What was, can you say what? Like,
yeah,
can you
sure.
Say what the
well, the biggest
you got
yeah,
was?
The biggest offer was a $1 million advance.
Okay.
For book one, which is something that usually, you know, if you're a writer, it really never happens, almost never happens.
Sure.
unless you're a super famous rock star writer.
So hold on a second there. You had raised $1 million basically on your own, and you would have kept that million that you'd raised, and then they would have gotten the rights for $1 million basically.
Yeah.
So you'd have gotten $2 million in total. Mm-hmm. I mean, for, you know, having been like 6 months earlier wondering if the company can continue, to then suddenly having, you know,
$2 million
in profit on the table. What was the calculus you went through to go, okay, we don't need that million. We're going to own the whole stack. and this is why. What was the thinking there?
Because we're crazy, as you know, from that very first email. Well,
I don't think you're crazy. I think you're really smart.
I mean, we took a big risk, of course. I mean, this could have gone completely wrong, and right. we sure. could have ruined it.
Fulfillment sucks.
Fulfillment and distribution is are horrible, and you know, it was completely new for us, so we didn't know anything about fulfillment and third party logistics when we started fulfilling right. the campaign. You know, it never really crossed our mind to sell the rights for 1 million. We thought that this could become something bigger, and we thought that we, you know, worked so hard and learned so much over the, you know, previous years, that we could really finally have this opportunity to take all of that and try to scale it to the next level. Mm. It was a bet, and it was a risk, but we like risks, I guess, and you know, we like challenges, and also we love the idea of trying to create this independent publishing model that could break new ground and also disrupt the traditional publishing model, where typically you need a big publisher, right, to make a lot of money and to sell a lot of books. So we were able to get to the New York Times bestsellers list with no publisher behind us and with no distribution right. behind us, because we have a direct-to-consumer approach. So we are also the distributor of our books. And to us, you know, these kind of results, which, you know, maybe if you're not an insider of the publishing industry, you don't think about that. But it's one of those things that really, like, get us excited.
Right. Well, I mean, you're doing the thing that you set out to do, you know, when you started, which was to kind of take the promise of all these new mediums and produce something beautiful and magical and inspiring. And just because the end artifact is a physical book, which is, you know, what, it's an old thing, everything you've done along the way has been new. Everything. This book couldn't have been made 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Everything mm-hmm. that you've used to make this book is because you've leveraged contemporary systems.
Yeah.
And because you had this digital experience, so you weren't afraid of it.
Yeah.
And going forward, I mean, it really feels like you've set the foundation for a kind of freedom that I think creators like you deserve. And I don't know if you feel mm-hmm. that as well, but like, you put in a lot of work honing your voice and understanding who you want to be in the world and what kinds of things you want to put in the world. And through these books, you found that fit, and you found a permission from all of these people, all 42 languages. That's incredible. All these people around the world are giving you permission to do the thing that you've always felt in your heart to do. I think that's pretty amazing.
Thank you. No, this is so beautiful, so beautifully said. And I agree completely, especially on the freedom piece of it, because it is true. It's we always fight for our independence, our freedom as creators, as producers. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons why we decided not to sell the rights to any big publishers. We knew that, you know, the moment you do it, you lose control. And so to be in control of your, fully in control of your, you know, creativity, you also, most of the times, you need the economic control. And so this was the perfect combination for us, the crowdfunding campaign and all, and everything that's surrounding that. It just gave us the perfect opportunity to have both the creative and the economic control, which is something so rare for creators, I believe, that when you have a chance to have it, you should keep it.
Well, it's so rare in part because all of the things that you're doing, most people don't want to do, right? So like, a lot of people give up control because they don't want to deal with the logistics. They don't want to deal with fulfillment. They don't want to think about production. But not only are you comfortable with like these messy technical things, which you've proven over the years, but you also have the storytelling chops. So it's like, you're kind of, I mean, people talk about unicorns, but I feel like Timbuktu, you know, is one of these media unicorns.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear. That's the unicorns. Best. Yeah, that's the best compliment.
Italian,
yeah.
An Italian media unicorn sitting in a kitchen.
Sitting in a kitchen. Right. Right. Stuff. I love this. I love this. We need a comic
an
or an illustration. Yeah.
thank you so much for taking
the time. Thank you. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Give Francesca.
Yes, I will. I will. Bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. Hey, thank you for listening to episode 4. I'm back in my home studio now, no longer on the mountain. And, you know, that makes me a little bit sad. It was an incredible walk I just did. And when I recorded that intro, I wasn't kidding when I said I had just spent a couple days thinking about the people and the institutions that are like a guiding light to me or that are inspiring. And Elena is definitely one of those people. And listening to this interview again now, weeks later, I feel that more strongly than ever. And so, you know, I just want to give a big thanks to her for taking the time out of her super busy schedule to get on the phone with me, hop on Skype, and do that call. Because they were in the middle of launching a bunch of new stuff, including their new podcast, which you should totally go and check out. It's incredible. And I know that so many people are going to get so much out of what Elena had to say in this podcast that I'm just grateful that we had that time to put this together. So thank you, thank you, thank you, Elena. And thank you to all of the listeners out there. I've been kind of overwhelmed by the amount of responses I got to some questions about having people help out with this podcast. You know, you kind of have these vague senses of reach of things online, sometimes more vague than others. And it's really nice to know that there are people out there listening and enjoying this. And if you are and want to help out, one of the most tangible things you can do to have a positive effect on this is to, well, obviously link to it or tweet about it or put it up on your Mastodon or whatever the heck we're using today. But you can also go and leave a review in the iTunes store, and that would be a huge help. So thank you in advance to all of you who have left reviews, and we will catch you in the next episode. Bye-bye.